From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Religious freedom is the first freedom spelled out in the U.S. Constitution's Bill of Rights, but a recent NC State University speaker explained that freedom of religion faces continual attacks in today's America. The level of political competition in a community can have an impact on the level of charitable giving. That's one of the more interesting findings in recent research from NC State's Institute for Nonprofits. The governor and state house leaders have offered public support for a statewide school bond, but Senate leaders have unveiled an alternative. It's designed to devote $2 billion to school construction without incurring new debt. You'll learn details. You'll also hear expert analysis of both proposals. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Governor Roy Cooper's State of the State address hit on policy proposals that he's been advocating for many months now. Things like expanding Medicaid by about 500,000 people or so, and spending more money on teachers and K-12 education. Now, with the legislature back in session and the next state operating budget being written as we speak, the question that faces North Carolina now is whether or not the governor is sending the state down the right path. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President for the John Locke Foundation. She follows all of these issues at the legislature very closely and joins us now to talk about the governor's views. Becky, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
In listening and reading the governor's State of the State address, it was rather interesting. He seems to come down clearly based on my ear and my read to expanding state government.
Absolutely. You know, he talked about sort of the theme was determined. And as I listened to the speech, it seemed to me that he is determined for more dependency on government. I mean, almost every issue that he brought up, it was almost like a pat on someone's head, on the citizens of North Carolina's head. Don't worry, we'll take care of you. Whether it's Medicaid expansion, whether it's hurricane recovery, whether it is education, whether it is school construction, school facilities, transportation, school safety, you know, any of those things, it was kind of, you know, trust me and we'll take care of this for you. The contrast with that was Senator Berger's response, where Senator Berger talked about opportunity and opening up opportunity for North Carolinians. So, you know, I think you're exactly right. If there was a theme and you really saw the clear division or the different ways of approaching the problems that and the challenges that face our state, from the governor's viewpoint, government will take care of it. Not quite sure who's going to pay for that. That was the kind of the big question at the end. You mentioned the budget. You know, as he went through this, I kind of kept adding up things in my head and thinking, you know, we're looking at a huge tax increase or huge transfer of money around the state if he's going to do all these things for real. And then when you heard Senator Berger talk about opening up opportunities, continuing with the tax reforms, the regulatory reform, the investments in government to allow people to pursue the opportunity in their dreams. Very, very different vision for North Carolina.
And speaking of that very different vision, we heard once again from Governor Cooper calling for an expansion of Medicaid, a health insurance program that was originally designed to help widows and the poor. Becky, he wants to add about 500,000 North Carolinians to the Medicaid rolls. There appears to be support for that growing in the state of North Carolina. But once again, Senator Berger would have a different viewpoint on that.
Absolutely. And, you know, Donna, I have listened, gone back and listened and checked the transcript. And what Roy Cooper said was he's going to expand Medicaid, health insurance. And again, to your point, this was a program that was developed in the 1930s under the Social Security Act that was designed as a social safety net for aged, disabled, poor pregnant women and children to give them a hands up in getting back on their feet, going through hard times, or you know, helping, providing that social safety net, if you will. how far have we come in all these years? You know, today we have the governor of the ninth largest state proposing that we're going to expand Medicaid to include health insurance, providing health insurance to most of those 500,000 people, Donna, are able-bodied, childless, working-age adults. So this is a completely different vision of what Medicaid was designed for. It's also very expensive. You know, and I think that I heard Governor Cooper say it wasn't going to cost North Carolina a dime. Now, I'm not
how,
sure.
How's that possible?
Yeah, I'm not sure how that's possible. You know, yes, there is a commitment from the federal government to pay a portion of this, and other states have done this. You know, other states have gotten in financial trouble. Other states have seen that their estimates going into it were way lower than what it ended up costing them. There's also no guarantee that the federal government is going to continue to pay for this. And let me just remind everybody of two things. Number one, the federal government gets their money from taxpayers, those of us right here in North Carolina. And, you know, coming up here on April 15th, when we're all going to be filing those federal tax returns, you know, it's a reminder of that. The other thing is the federal government is trillions of dollars in debt. I mean, how long do you think they're going to be able to keep these things afloat? The other thing that concerns me about his Medicaid expansion proposal, aside from, again, it's adding 500,000 at least able-bodied, childless, working-age adults, it also is a program that the very way that it's managed is going through a real transition here in North Carolina, moving to a managed care model that we're still trying to figure out, is this the best way to provide those services? Are we going to be able to have services for everybody who is on Medicaid today, much less add all these other folks? And this just seems like to be a very expensive, very unproven, but one that I guess sounds good on a campaign trail, you know, free stuff for everybody.
You know, your point about Medicaid undergoing this big transition of how services are provided and things like that, we don't yet know
right.
if there are benefits to making that change or if it turns out that maybe it was the wrong way to do something. So it seems like trying to add a bunch of people to the system when it's undergoing such a transformation just as asking for, at the very least, questions, if not trouble.
Right. And Donna, what you do is you put those people, again, going back to what this program was designed for aged, disabled, pregnant women. You know, we've talked a lot, and the governor mentioned in his remarks, too, about the opioid crisis. We have a lot of people who have severe drug addiction who are receiving services through Medicaid. When you start adding on to that program to the tune of 500,000 additional people, and again, the sort of different population, what that does is it puts those very fragile people that are on Medicaid now really in danger of whether or not we're going to be able to provide those services at the same quality, have that access to the care that, again, the people that were designed to receive Medicare this way. Now, that doesn't mean
Medicaid.
I'm sorry. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, there is not certainly an argument and a challenge to making sure that people can afford health insurance. But there's a lot of things that are happening. We'll see if the governor supports this kind of stuff. He didn't talk about it the other night. I think Phil Berger mentioned it. But things like where small business associations could come together and design insurance products that would be more affordable, that people can afford, can choose and have options in the health insurance that it fits best for their particular situation, for their family, begin to looking at ways to lower the cost of health care through telemedicine, repealing certificate of need, scope of practice, revising some supervisory burdens that we have in North Carolina. You know, there's a whole menu of things that we can start looking at, which I believe, and many of us on the right side of things, figuratively and literally, I will say, you know, to lower the cost of health care so that health insurance is more affordable so that people can afford their insurance rather than depending on government.
Becky, I want to make sure we talk about Governor Cooper's comments in the State of the State about K-12 education in North Carolina. He was advocating for more teacher pay, more spending on education. And as I was listening and then went back and read his comments, I thought, well, we have seen increases in spending and teacher raises for multiple years in a row. Apparently, he thinks that's not enough.
Well, you know, and there is a question. I mean, you know, how much is a good teacher in a classroom worth? I mean, in my view, they're worth their weight in gold. And we should look at paying teachers well. We should look at paying good teachers well and giving them opportunities to advance in their career in the classroom, not moving into administrative positions. But, you know, let me just remind folks, number one, teachers have gotten 5 consecutive pay increases under Republican leadership, and there were promises made last year that this year in this budget that teacher pay would be increased to an average of $55,000 a year. And so teachers can look for another pay increase this year.
Becky Gray, thank you.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Debates about religious freedom have generated plenty of headlines in recent years, and our next guest has been watching these debates very closely. Ashley McGuire is a senior fellow with the Catholic Association. She recently spoke at NC State University. The theme, First Freedom, Religious Liberty, and the Constitution. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So the title says something that's very important, First Freedom. Religious freedom really is the first one that's spelled out in the Bill of Rights. It also seems to be one that faces quite a number of attacks, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's important to note that the founders made it the first freedom that they addressed in the Bill of Rights, because if you read the founders on the topic, they believed that religious freedom actually precedes the state, that it's an inalienable right that comes from God. It's something that the state doesn't give you. It's there to protect, and therefore they can't take away. But you're right that especially in the last 10 years, there's been a real erosion of respect for religious liberty as a principle. You know, increasingly I see the phrase appear in scare quotes as if it's a fake concept. And an uptick in cases all around the country related to religious liberty.
One of the cases that generated quite a few headlines in the past year or so involved the baker who was compelled to make a cake for a same-sex marriage, said, no, my religious beliefs forbid me from doing this, was taken to court, lost at the state level. But the Supreme Court ended up saying that it was true that he should not have to bake this cake, but seemed to open the door that further challenges of this type could be made.
I think we should expect that they will. And I think that's because what's really started to happen in recent years is a creep of this idea that religion is something that's only private, something that exists in the four walls of your church or in the four walls of your home, but it's something you check at the door when you go to work. It's something that doesn't belong in the public square. And that's a real move away from what the founders intended. And what that ends up doing is resulting in a direct violation of conscience rights, which is what we saw in the case of Jack Phillips. And what we're starting to see in a lot of other cases. I mean, there was another big Supreme Court case this past term that related to pregnancy centers, most of which are run by faith-based organizations. You know, one of them actually in a basement, one of the plaintiffs in a basement in a Catholic church, where they were being forced to advertise for abortion in direct violation of the religious beliefs of those running the centers. So that's just another example.
You referenced the founders. Remind us, what did the founders see as the role of religion in our society, in the public square?
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, the founders viewed religion as an extension of property rights. In fact, Madison called it the most sacred property, one's conscience. So they viewed it as an essential and inalienable right, as I said, something that precedes the state. Secondly, they viewed religion as an essential bulwark for liberty. The founders were explicit, all of them, in stressing that freedom cannot exist without religion there to strengthen the virtue that's needed to maintain a free society. And finally, the founders recognize that religious pluralism is inherent to human nature, that we're not going to see religious uniformity. That's why they were opposed to a national established church. And they set up a system that left room for diversity, which is why we today have the most religiously pluralistic country in the world.
We are speaking with Ashley McGuire, senior fellow with the Catholic Association, also recent speaker at NC State University, on the theme, First Freedom, Religious Liberty, and the Constitution. We referenced the Baker. You referenced another case that has been moving through the courts. What are some of the other typical challenges that we see to religious freedom these days?
Well, in my speech, I identify three areas to watch. One is the area of healthcare, where you're increasingly seeing healthcare providers being forced to do things that violate their conscience. For example, pharmacists being required to dispense abortion-causing drugs, or doctors or hospitals that are religious being forced to cover or perform things like transgender surgeries. So that's a big issue area to watch. The second issue area, I would say, has to do with public memorials. So there's actually a case that was just granted cert at the Supreme Court having to do with a World War I cross memorial large in Maryland. And there's memorials like this all across the country that are memorials to fallen soldiers. And whether or not that those memorials can continue to be displayed in public is being challenged. And finally, I would say the area of sort of gender ideology. So a big area where you're seeing the clash between sort of the culture and religious liberty has to do with adoption. So there are several big cases percolating in the country where religious adoption agencies are basically being forced to shut down or violate their religious tenets when it comes to placing children with same-sex couples. So that's another area to watch.
Some people listening to us, I think, are probably going to think to themselves, well, all these are signs of an evolving society, changing mores. Why should we let religion stand in the way of these various goals? Why is it important to protect people's religious freedom and not force them to go with what is now politically correct?
Well, first of all, religion is inherent to human nature. That, as my mentor, Seamus Hassan, who founded the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, used to put it, we're all born with our eyes fixed on the horizons. It's sort of natural to us to want to pursue, each in our own way, the dictates of our conscience and faith in different ways. That doesn't mean that everybody's religious. I'm well aware that there are a lot of atheists in this country. But that it's important that we be able to coexist with each other as different faith groups and also with those who disagree with us. I think it's important to recognize that disagreeing is not necessarily discrimination, that you can disagree with someone about, you know, the meaning of marriage, for example, and not be discriminating against them. But I think that religious liberty is foundational to any good free society. And plenty of studies have shown that religious liberty also acts as a bulwark for other freedoms as well, economic freedoms, women's rights, things like that.
And people who defend religious freedom, I've never heard anyone who says they want to use religious freedom to stand in the way of something that someone else wants. It's basically, don't force me to have to do something that violates my conscience, but that doesn't mean I'm going to stand in the way of your beliefs.
Sure. And I think that's a common misperception that people who are asking for religious freedom, who are wanting to obey their conscience, are trying to prevent somebody else from, you know, accessing what's, you know, rightfully their freedom. But no, I mean, I think it's important to go back to the wording of the Constitution itself. It's about the free exercise of religion. And that's something, it's very much an individual liberty. I mean, there's certainly a collective nature to it in that, but it's important to remember that religious liberty is a broad and robust freedom. It's one that entails and touches on a lot of other aspects of life. It entails religious attire. It entails speech and expression. It entails the ability to construct a house of worship. So it's a freedom that intertwines with a lot of other different civil liberties.
Well, it's certainly a very important topic, and the topic at NC State University was titled First Freedom, Religious Liberty and the Constitution. The speaker and our guest, Ashley McGuire, Senior Fellow with the Catholic Association. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Does North Carolina need a statewide school construction bond? Senate leaders don't think so. Majority Leader Harry Brown describes an alternative. It would shift more money to the state's capital and infrastructure fund.
Our bill will add 0.5% of net general fund tax revenue to the SCIF, bringing the total to 4.5% each year. We'll also dedicate 1/3 of the SCIF to capital and maintenance for K-12 schools, 1/3 to UNC and community colleges, and 1/3 to state agencies. This will result in a little over $2 billion for each category over the next 9 years.
Why is this better than a bond?
We agree with our colleagues elsewhere in government that school capital is a priority. We just think that our plan is the right way to go, because it dedicates more money faster and for less cost. The nonpartisan fiscal research division crunched the numbers based on the Debt Affordability Advisory Committee's most recent guidance, and here's what they reported. A $1.9 billion bond will cost $1.2 billion in interest payments over the next 30 years. bringing the total spend to $3.1 billion. Spending $3.1 billion to get $1.9 billion might be necessary if there weren't alternatives, but we feel like there are. Our bill dedicates a little over $2 billion with zero interest payments. It provides the full funding over just 9 years, compared to 10 years it would take for a bond under the Debt Affordability Advisory Committee's recommendations. The bottom line is the Building North Carolina Future Act provides more money to schools, costs the state less, and delivers the funding faster than a debt-financed bond does. And our plan starts delivering funds in 2019, a full 2 years earlier than a bond. Counties can start addressing their school capital needs now rather than waiting.
Does this mean the Senate is more averse to taking on new debt?
I think that's fair to say. But also, you can see with the other plan, with a bond plan, you're talking about over $1 billion in interest payments, where with this plan, you don't have any of that. So it just allows you to spend more money on where you want it to be spent.
If the economy turns south, will the money dry up?
It's all about priorities. And I think all of you know, when you start the budget process, you've got a certain amount of availability and you set those priorities. And we think this is a priority that's important all across the state. I don't think there's a county in this state that wouldn't tell you that they need help with capital projects, especially in K-12.
That's State Senate Majority Leader Harry Brown. He's discussing an alternative to a proposed $2 billion state school construction bond. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. There's an ongoing debate in politics. Who is more generous? Who donates more money to charitable causes, Republicans or Democrats? North Carolina State University professor Richard Clerken doesn't offer a simple answer, but he and his colleagues at the Institute for Nonprofits are conducting research. It sheds light on the issue.
One of the things that we're doing with our research is to try to look at this relationship between how we tax ourselves and what impact that has on our philanthropy, in addition to what is going on with the political competition and ideology.
So what does the research say about Republican versus Democratic charitable contributions?
The literature is a little bit unsettled about who is more, and people use this word, generous. Generous, once again, is a wrong term to use, given most of the data that people have. It's who gives more donations, Republicans or Democrats. This is just part of that sort of ideological fight that goes on. Art Brooks and others point to some research that says Republicans, once you control for lots of things, tend to be more generous than Democrats. Wolf Bielefeld and others will say that Democrats are more generous, and a lot of it has to do with where the data are coming from and the types of sources that people are using. And then finally, there's some work by Paul Shervis and John Havens that says, well, it's sort of both. And we're building off of their work. What they have done is they've looked at giving across the 50 states and controlling for tax burden, controlling for cost of living, and lots of other things. When they start ranking which states give sort of higher amounts relative to the adjusted gross income that gets done, that it's really mixed. There are some states that are deep blue that are high up on the list, and there are some that are deep red that are high up on the list. So what they're trying to say is that it's a lot more complicated story than just Republican versus Democrat when it comes to understanding how much people give.
Clerken turned to his own research. He started with one finding that should surprise no one.
One of the things that we see in terms of tax burden, the greater the proportion in the county that votes Republican, the lower the tax burden. This is not an unexpected finding that we have here. What's a little bit more interesting, especially when we're controlling for that, is what goes on with donations. And really what's from a policy perspective, from someone who cares about philia, who cares about philanthropy, our counties that voted closer to 50-50 across those presidential elections are the ones that tended to donate the least.
That's NC State Professor Richard Clerken of the Institute for Nonprofits. He spoke recently to the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. He just told the audience that charitable donations tend to be lower in areas with the closest political competition. Why might that be true?
If I think about sort of some theories of the nonprofit sector, this isn't necessarily surprising. So Lester Solomon talks about sort of the failures theory of the nonprofit sector, that the reason why we have government is because philanthropy and nonprofits, the voluntary sector, isn't able to meet all of the needs of the folks. So he talks about there being four types of philanthropic voluntary sector failures. One is philanthropic insufficiency. If we look across our history, we tend to donate about 2% of GDP, no matter where we are in our economic cycle or no matter what our tax structure is. 2% of GDP plus or minus a couple of tenths of percent. Now, in a $19 trillion economy, a couple of a tenths of percent is real money, right? But overall, if we're voluntarily giving and we think we need more than 2% of GDP to accomplish our broader public purposes, it's not going to come only from philanthropy. A second problem is the failure of philanthropic particularism. 60 to 70% of philanthropy is what's referred to, and philanthropy in this case, I'm talking about donations, is referred to as consumption philanthropy. We give to those nonprofits whose services we use. Houses of worship, universities, go pack, please make a donation to the Institute, especially if you're an alum. We give to hospitals or disease organizations that our family members have been affected by. 60 to 70% of our philanthropy goes to those nonprofits whose services we use.
There are a couple of other so-called philanthropic failures.
There's the philanthropic paternalism is another thing, sort of the moralizing history of what philanthropy is. It's sort of that idea of the rich doing to the poor. And then finally, philanthropic amateurism. Given most of the work in the nonprofit sector is what we would traditionally call women's work, it tends not to be well compensated, and historically it has not been sort of what professionally run. So because of these limits to the philanthropic sector, philanthropy can't take care of things on its own. And part of what's going on down here, if we are living in communities where half the people don't think like we do, we're giving less. We're more likely to give money when we've sort of sorted into counties where more people at least think politically like we do. So this is a potentially little bit of a concerning finding that we have going on here.
Richard Clerken of North Carolina State University's Institute for Nonprofits says the research yields some other interesting takeaways.
Overall, Republican-leaning counties do seem, on average, all else equal, donate at relatively higher levels than non-Republican-leaning counties. Overall, total wealth redistribution is higher in Democratic-leaning counties.
What about that finding that charitable contributions go down in areas with hot political competition?
That's a little bit concerning, this idea of political competition, being in those mixed communities, right? That means we're potentially engaging less with folks to solve our problems.
Carolina Journal Radio asked Clerken whether there's any link between the amount of money flowing to charity and the amount of money flowing to political campaigns, especially in these hotly contested areas with 50-50 ideological splits.
Great question. I have no idea. I don't know. I don't know the data to answer that question. So there's a couple of other limitations here. One is we don't know about political giving. And that would be really interesting to see how it goes on at the county level. We also can't separate out secular versus religious giving. We can control for religiosity in the county. So there's a lot of noise going on there that we can't quite sort of drill down to answer that question. But it's an interesting insight. If we can find the right data, then we could definitely look at it.
Clerkin says there's no one-to-one link between giving and tax rates.
Giving isn't just rational responses to a tax structure. There are emotional reasons for giving, and there are normative civic duty reasons for giving. And we need to think about that full panoply of motivations for people to be engaged in donating and volunteering than just the marginal tax rate. So that's why in higher rates of volunteering and giving in Nordic countries, which are also high tax welfare states. Because there's a lot of other stuff that's going on that drives how we relate to each other in society.
So that leads Clerkin and colleagues back to the theory that people who are split ideologically might not want to make charitable donations that end up supporting their political opponents.
That's our conjecture at this point, but we haven't done the so that's going to take some qualitative work to go in and talk with folks, and we haven't done that work yet. So I think you're asking a really good question. We can hypothesize about why that's going on, but we don't know for sure.
That's North Carolina State University Professor Richard Clerkin. He leads the Institute for Nonprofits. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The state of North Carolina estimates that our state has more than $8 billion worth of immediate school capital needs. Now, Governor Cooper and some in the legislature would like to see a nearly $2 billion school construction bond on the November ballot, while other lawmakers are more friendly to the idea of using existing funds to pay as we go. The John Locke Foundation's Dr. Terry Stoops has been assessing the need and the options going forward. He joins us now to talk about that. Terry, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
How pressing are the needs for schools in terms of facilities across the state?
Well, it varies. In some places, they have sufficient facilities and they've planned ahead to meet their maintenance costs, any additions that they need for increasing student enrollment. So there are some districts that are in a fine position as far as school facilities go. These mainly are urban and suburban districts. The rural districts in North Carolina might be a different story. I mean, some of these districts have schools that are very old. And so they actually do have actual facilities needs that probably need to be attended to sooner rather than later. But there isn't sort of one typical need that each county has. It really varies between needing new construction, additions to current construction, or renovations of existing construction.
You've also been writing about the fact that in many parts of North Carolina, and people might be surprised to learn this, but enrollment is actually dropping in public schools.
That's right.
Would factor into the needs, would it not?
Absolutely, because a lot of especially rural districts created small elementary schools scattered around the county, given the difficulties of getting students to school and not forcing them to ride on a bus for an hour and a half every day. And so now we're coming to a situation in many rural districts where they have small under-enrolled elementary schools scattered across the district. And so these are districts that have had to grapple with the difficult choice, and it really is a difficult choice, of trying to keep these small under-enrolled schools open or combining schools and getting that enrollment in just a few elementary schools rather than several. So there are a lot of interesting dynamics happening, especially in these rural communities. And that's just the facilities that they have, doesn't really talk about how to pay for them.
Based on those differences across counties and districts, it would seem to make sense then that the solution to an individual area's needs has got to be quite personalized, that it would be difficult to put together a one-size-fits-all answer to this.
Well, that was the idea when the state decided that the counties would primarily be responsible for school construction. And this is nothing new. We have had an arrangement in North Carolina since the 1930s where the state would pick up the majority of expenses for student operating expenses. And the counties would take care of the capital expenses. They would take care of the school buildings and the maintenance required to keep up those school buildings. Now, in various times through history in North Carolina, we have had the state step in to provide funds for localities for their school facilities needs, but mainly they have relied on generating their own tax funds to pay for the bonds or the other types of debt that a county can take out for school construction. So we're seeing now an increasing call to change that and have the state play more of a role in school construction, which is much different than what the original designs for how those responsibilities will be handled occurred in the 1930s.
And in fact, that leads us to our discussion that we are now starting to hear pretty seriously and robustly from members of not only the North Carolina General Assembly, but we're hearing from the governor on this. Terry, it seems like the discussion has now boiled down to an either-or option to address this. You have the governor and some members of the legislature who say, you know what, we need a statewide school construction bond. It needs to go on the ballot. Voters need to say yes or no. You have other lawmakers who are saying, look, you know, it's probably a better idea not to take on debt and let's pay as we go and let's figure out where the needs are. Give us your sense, first of all, is it an either or? And what are the pros and cons of those two approaches?
Well, they don't have to do either, certainly. And they could say that historically and according to state statute that the counties are primarily responsible for school facilities, and they would be well within their right to do that. But legislators on both sides of the aisle and in both chambers have decided that there's something that the state is going to do, and that something boils down to the two options that you mentioned. The bond, of course, is something that we've done in North Carolina in the past, a statewide bond for school facilities. And we did it in 1996 was the last year that the state provided a bond for school facilities. Now, that's not the only thing the state does. It's worth mentioning that the good old lottery provides money every year for school facilities. So the state is involved in facilities in a certain way. The bond would basically take the idea of putting a choice before voters about whether the state can authorize this debt. And then if the voters approve, then they sell bonds into the open market to buyers, get the money from the buyers, and then distribute the funds from the sale of those bonds to school districts.
The other option says, no, let's not take on debt to do this. But some lawmakers say, we've got money now. We can maybe add some money to a fund and let's pay for this as we go along.
Yes, because bonds come with interest. And what the Senate is saying, that we can avoid $1.2 billion in interest paid to the folks that buy up the bonds and instead do a pay-as-you-go plan. This would provide a dedicated amount of money each year to be distributed for school capital expenses. It's an approach that the Senate has really taken on for not just school facilities, but state facilities as well. They believe that this is a more responsible plan. The only there are downsides to this plan, and one of them is that you have to wait till the money comes in. Unlike bonds, you can't sell, say, $300 million in bonds in the open market and get that money almost immediately. So this would take time, but it would avoid an enormous amount of interest payments that could be used for other things.
Terry, you wrote a very interesting piece recently for the Greensboro News and Record, and you really keyed in on what you believe is the key to success going forward. You say there have to be fresh ideas, fresh ways of looking at this situation. You brought up an issue of public-private partnerships and that maybe school districts need to think more seriously about that. How would that work?
Well, this would be asking the private sector what they could do and how they can help, and how a relationship between a school district and the private sector can effectively build schools. Now, to overcome some of the issues that we have with that would require, of course, close oversight of such a public-private partnership to ensure that no one's getting swindled or anything like that. But we have to start asking the private sector what they can do, and we have to start considering what the school districts are willing to accept as far as school facilities. For years, we have operated on what I call a wish fulfillment model of school buildings, and that's that we have built the school that everyone wishes they had. But we're in a situation now with $8 billion in needs that require us to start rethinking the types of school buildings that we build. And I feel like a partnership between the private sector and a school district could help us get to that point where we meet those needs and perhaps build the school buildings that we need going forward.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.